Boy, this next panel is something that's dear to my heart, and I know Gene and VZ are both on ready to go. Independent travel keeps getting harder and harder. Boy, I'll say, I had a situation the other day. The Uber vehicle dropped me off a little bit in an unexpected spot, and geez, I couldn't find the darn ticket machine at the train station. I had to call Be My Eyes to get help. And it's a place I've been to many times before. So I guess as we get older, our hearing gets a little bit diminished, and well, we don't do quite as well as we used to do. So Gene, if it's okay with you, I'll turn it over to you and let you get this next panel started. It's a little bit
Okay,
early,
thank you, Rob.
10:57.
For those who are unfamiliar with myself, my name is Gene Lozano. I'm the chair of the Committee on Access and Transportation and a member of the Conference and Convention Planning Committee. For many years, both committees have heard from the membership that it's getting harder to independently travel in the ever-increasing complexities of the built environment. And that can be the interior of buildings, which like elevators. We're used to push buttons to operate buttons to the call buttons to operate the elevators to come to your floor. And complexity, it's now in recent time, is destination-based elevators. And I've heard that there's somebody in the elevator industry thinking that everyone should use iPads to call a elevator to the floor and not have any push buttons. Our focus this morning is to do with exterior challenges in the built environment. And this is something that we have addressed in our last convention when we had two different presentations, one by Donna Sallenberger, who is an O&M specialist who was helping us understand how to assess when it's safe to make a crossing at an unsignalized crossing. And then we had another presentation from Dr. Eugene Borkum, who was talking about how we can influence the yielding behavior of drivers. This morning is the next part of that series of what field development and modifications can be made to the built environment. And I'm very honored this morning to introduce a very good friend, colleague, and an ally on matters related to making the built environment more accessible for people with vision disabilities. Our presenter is Dr. Billy Louise Benson, known to many of us as BZ. She is an orientation mobility specialist, who also has a PhD in experimental psychology. For more than 40 years, BZ has conducted human factors research work in the areas of wayfinding and mobility for people with vision disabilities. More specifically, he has done at least 30 human factors research projects in the areas of large print, tactile, electronic, and audible signage, tactile maps, visual contrast, accessible pedestrian signals, detectable warnings, the accessibility of roundabouts, and a variety of electronic wayfinding technologies, such as one of the earlier technologies you might recall that she has done a lot of work in, which was talking signs. As a result of Abizi's research work, there have been many changes that are that have resulted in the changes into documents such as the ANSI A117.1 2009 standards for making accessible and usable the for buildings and facilities, U.S. Department of Transportation's ADA transportation facilities standards, the Federal Highway Administration Manual Uniform Traffic Control Devices, and there's and more recently has been the U.S. Access Board's draft ADA accessibility provisions for the making the public right-of-way accessible. And additionally, Beazie has published at least 80 articles, as well as numerous reports and chapters for books. Finally, Dr. Benson is the founder of Accessibility Design for Accessible Design for the Blind, which is a company involving human factors research and consultation in making the built environment more accessible to people with disabilities. And she is currently the company's director of research. It gives me a group, I wish to again say that we have been very fortunate to have Easy as a longtime friend and ally. Many of the changes that have improved our accessibility in the built environment is due because of her work. And she is going to be bringing to you right now a reminder of this and going over the strategies in our tool inventory of how to we find the crosswalks, how to make a straight crossing, and on top of that, making some suggestions as to environmental modifications, which can be technologies that her research has found that has been very helpful. So I wish to ask everyone to give her a warm virtual hand of applause. Thank you very much.
Beazie, it's yours.
Thank you for that introduction, Jean. Sorry, I was a little tardy in turning my microphone on. Jean and I go back a long ways, I think maybe about 30 years. We first met at an ANSI meeting when we were trying to get some standards for detectable warnings at that time. And I remember Jean's support in that, and also Jean at that time was advocating for accessible ATMs. And I didn't think that there was a chance that we would get that in the ANSI because there wasn't an accessible ATM. And normally they're talking about things that exist. But by golly, he got them to accept that. And look where that's gone now. But one of the things that was important to me at that time, and it has remained important to me in all of the advocacy that I do, is making sure that what I'm promoting is really consistent with what blind people are wanting. When I have the opportunity to work with people from ACB, I welcome that chance, and I really welcome this opportunity to be with CCB today. I'm with you remotely from Fairbanks, Alaska, where I live in a one-room cabin. It's called a dry cabin here. That means that I have to haul my water, and I have an outhouse. It's really good for me to, after most of my life living with plumbing and in a more conventional way, to discover how happy I can be in just one room. And this is good learning for an 84-year-old. Anyhow, I'm really happy to talk with you this morning about how independent travel keeps getting harder. And one of the things I want to emphasize is that it really is getting harder. You know, if you used to be able to cross a particular street easily and you can't anymore, it may be because something about the environment has changed. It's now possible to change the signalization from a remote transportation center. You know, nobody has to come to the intersection even to change the timing on something. So you may have no idea and no real way to know that a signal has been changed. And there are many very complex kinds of signalization these days. And so if something doesn't seem right to you, it seems like there's a change, well, probably there is. And one thing that you might try doing is finding out who's in control of that intersection. And that may take you a few phone calls. So have patience with it, because you know, who controls what in the traffic control world can be quite confusing. But eventually you'll get there and talk to the person that controls that intersection and say, you know, I used to be able to do this. I'm having trouble now. Did something change? And find out. But let me get on to talking about how to find hard to find crosswalks or bus stops. Particularly, it's hard to find crosswalks at roundabouts and channelized turn lanes, and what are now referred to as categorically innovative intersections. And these are like roundabouts multiplied many times over. And there are many kinds of them. And fortunately, how you deal with them and finding a crossing is the same. So I can talk about displaced left turn intersections or displaced left turn interchanges or restricted crossing U-turn intersections or median U-turn intersections or a quadrant roadway intersection or a double crossover diamond interchange. And you don't really have to know about any of those. The strategy for finding the crosswalk is the same as it would be for a roundabout. Unless there is some cue that has been installed or you've traveled around about enough to have identified your own cue, the best way to find a crosswalk at a roundabout or channelized turn lane at it applies to any one of these innovative intersections, is to trail your outside guideline, whether it's a grass line, you've got something between you and the road, or you're trailing the curb and you're really close to traffic, so you want to be extra cautious, but trail outside and be looking for a curb ramp or a detectable warning. And that will indicate that there is a pedestrian crossing there. So trail the outside, look for the ramp, look for the detectable warning, and you should be in a crosswalk. I know many of you probably prefer to travel away from the outside guideline, and that's safer, especially if there's nothing between you and the cars. At roundabouts, the roundabout guide for use for construction says that there should be something between the pedestrian and the traffic at a roundabout, but that's not always true. So sometimes you'll just have to trail along the curb line, listening carefully for traffic that may be traveling awfully close to you, to find the curb ramp and the detectable warning. And then that should put you in the crosswalk, kind of no matter which of these challenging places you're trying to find the crosswalk. I'd suggest for roundabouts and innovative intersections that you really get help with familiarization. For the roundabout, it's really helpful to understand how roundabouts work, and I'm not going to try to talk about that today. But try to get somebody to explain to you how they work. They're really not terrifying, especially if it's a single lane roundabout. One of the things about roundabouts and also about these crazy innovative intersections is that for all of them, you're only crossing traffic coming from one way at a time. And normally it's going to be coming from your left, although in the innovative intersections, it might be coming from the right, but it's only going to come from one way until you have a refuge or you're on the other side anyhow. Another comment just is that both the Access Board and Federal Highway are now recognizing that if a roundabout or the same thing would go for an innovative intersection, if it's two or more lanes, there should be some kind of a signal where there's a crossing. So for every crossing at a roundabout where there is more than one lane of traffic, there should be some kind of a signal or a beacon. And it'll be pedestrian actuated, and there ought to be an APS there. And if there isn't, you should ask for one. So finding bus stops, they can be hard too, especially if they're mid-block. The same strategy as looking for hard to find crosswalks will generally work, trailing the outside, maybe the curb line, and looking for a ramp or a detectable warning. It won't always be there, but that's a good strategy anyhow to try for finding mid-block bus stops. I'm going to talk a little bit later about floating bus stops that some of you may be quite concerned about. But right now, I'm going to talk about some possible environmental modifications for help finding crosswalks and bus stops. And that is the use of what's called generically a tactile walking surface indicator. And you probably are all familiar with the bumps or truncated domes that are usually at curb ramps now and edges of transit platforms. Those are called detectable warnings. And that is one kind of what generically is called a tactile walking surface indicator. So tactile, you can feel it on your walking surface. So with your feet or your cane, tactile walking surface indicator. So any of these are intended to do that. And the truncated domes or detectable warnings are one kind, and they're the only kind that has been widely used in the US to date. But there's another kind that is widely used in many other countries, and that is raised flat top bars, and they're ranged parallel to each other. And sometimes these are referred to as tactile direction indicators because they indicate the direction you should go. So they're a second kind of a tactile walking surface indicator. And they're raised about a quarter of an inch, same as the domes. The bars are about an inch wide, and about 2 inches between them. California, uniquely in the US, has specifications for the tactile direction indicator, the raised bars, and requires their use in subway stations to indicate where train doors open and so these I know are used in BART and Caltrans stations, LA Metro, I believe. The width of the installation may vary a little bit across different jurisdictions. But the typical use of these, rather than to indicate where a train door would open, is to be able to follow them in the direction you're going. When they're installed, and the idea is to create a path to follow, maybe across a plaza or some wide open space, a mezzanine in a big transit station, maybe. The bars go in the direction that you're going, and the installation is usually 12 inches wide. So if you're looking for it, it's not real wide. There's a possibility you could step over it. So you want to slow down, look carefully. It might continue for quite a long way. It's fine to cross the raised bars. There's no indication of a warning. They don't warn of anything. They say, you can safely walk here. Usually you can walk on either side. One side might not have as much room as the other, but usually it's safe to walk on either side. They should never be used to indicate a warning. But there's a lot of misuse of them in one particular situation that I just want to call to your attention, because it may be happening where you are. And that is where bicycles have what's called a protected bike lane that's up on the sidewalk. So it's on the same level that you're walking on. And there is the recognition that there has to be some kind of a delineator between the pedestrian part of the sidewalk and the bicycle part of the sidewalk. And it needs to be detectable to cane and to underfoot. And it needs to have a special meaning that lets you know there are bikes on the other side. But unfortunately, no really satisfactory delineator had been found until some research that I did in San Francisco 2 years ago. Some of you may have participated in that, in fact. And so jurisdictions have been using the bars, the tactile direction indicator, between pedestrians and bikes on sidewalk level. That gives a really wrong message, because you're supposed to, the bars are supposed to be a safe space. You're supposed to be able to go on either side. So they need a different tactile walking surface to say, no, there are bikes here. If you come to this, don't cross it. You're in danger of bikes on the other side. Now, I'm not going to debate whether bikes and pedestrians should be at the same level. That's probably the ship has sailed on that. Although if you get in early enough in planning, and I would encourage you to get involved in travel planning, transit engineering, transportation planning in your jurisdiction, and you may be able to get them to put bikes at a lower level. But a lot of jurisdictions are really wanting to put them at sidewalk level for a variety of reasons. And so I'll talk to you in a little bit what really should be there. But more on the raised bars. They can be used to locate a crosswalk or a bus stop. And also to give you an excellent cue for aligning where you don't have other cues or they're misleading. And if they're used that way, instead of being with the bars themselves going in the direction of travel, the bars are turned. Now, first I'll stop for a minute and say where they're installed. If the intent is to locate a crosswalk or bus stop, they'll go across the sidewalk. So as you walk down the sidewalk, you should come to this surface. And it'll be a raised bar surface, but the bars will be oriented. I would say the bars themselves are oriented in the direction if you're continuing to walk on the sidewalk. But if your intent is to find that crosswalk that they're marking or that bus stop that they're marking, you want to turn and walk toward the street at that point. And the two reasons those bars are turned differently and know that not as comfortable to follow. Your cane will tend to get stuck in them some if you're trying to follow them with your cane. two reasons. The advantage of that, from your point of view, is that they can give you a really secure alignment cue. Because the way they're installed, and they're 2 feet wide all the way across the sidewalk and coming down to near the curb. And that whole strip and the bars themselves are aligned perpendicular to the direction you're traveling across the crosswalk. That means that you square off with them. I don't know whether in O&Mers are teaching people to square off with a curb anymore. Their curbs are so seldom quite perpendicular to the direction you want to cross now, with widely rounded corners. But squaring off with these bars is much like squaring off with a curb. You get the bar under both feet, you make sure that it feels the same under both feet, and you're going to have good alignment in the direction of the crosswalk. Maybe traffic is going off in a little different direction. Maybe the curb ramp is pointing out in the middle of the intersection. But the raised bars are there to give you a secure way of alignment. And if they weren't turned perpendicular to the direction you're going to cross, so you can square off on them, you wouldn't be able to get as good a line. Just psychophysically, it's not possible for people to align as well with something that is going kind of in the axis of the foot. So going, you know, heel to toe, as going across the foot. And that's why the bars are turned that way. Incidentally, it's also much easier for people with mobility impairments, especially if they use wheeled devices. If they're continuing on that sidewalk, then it's kind of a non-issue to go across them. If they were turned the other way, every time they cross them, it would be, which can be very annoying. In some cases, can throw people into a spasm and be quite painful. And so you can imagine the hue and cry we'd have from people who are mobility impaired if this started to be used widely. But I think that probably it is going to be increasingly used, and that probably we won't have a lot of challenge from the mobility impaired community. I would expect some kickback in some locations. It certainly was not easy to get requirements for the detectable warnings because there was a lot of opposition amongst mobility impaired people. So we want to make this have the minimal effect on them. At the same time, letting you know where there's a crosswalk, mid-block, say, or a bus stop, and giving a secure way to a line that you know is going to point you in the right direction. Sometimes these can be used at a corner crossing where maybe it's a T intersection and you're crossing from the stem of the T up to the top. So there's no real parallel traffic that you can get an alignment cue from or to help to maintain your direction once you get started. So it's really important to have a good cue to square off with so you do get a good line. In that case, it only takes a 2 foot square of these bars. Again, the bars arranged perpendicular to your direction of travel across the crosswalk so that you can square off with them under both feet. Can just be a 2 foot square of them, and they'll be near the end of the domes on the side away from the center of the intersection. So how do you align and maintain your heading, your direction of travel, when there isn't any parallel traffic? Well, I can't suggest ways that are foolproof. I can suggest things that are likely to increase your ability to get across straight. Idling perpendicular traffic may be a good cue, but not a certain cue, because the stop bar might not always be parallel with the crosswalk. It is much more often than not, but it may not always be. And so if you're in a situation in which you don't have anything parallel that you can use for direction, listen for idling traffic on the street that you're going to cross. If you have somebody that you can confirm with that the idling traffic is in the direction of the crosswalk, then that can be helpful confirmation that, yeah, you can use that cue, and it's pretty likely to get you in a good alignment to start crossing. Another thing that you can try is using the straight part of the curb that is on the side of the curb ramp that's farthest from the center of the intersection. Some of you maybe have been taught that in O&M. I know that some people are teaching that now. And this may be perpendicular to the street you want to cross. That is, it may be in line with the crosswalk, but it also may not be at some intersections. And so, again, that's a good thing to confirm that the curb ramp is, in fact, perpendicular to the crosswalk. So if there's somebody, another pedestrian traveling beside you, you get on that bit of curb and square off, and then you can point to ask, you know, am I headed in the direction of the crosswalk? And, you know, they may say, no, it's a little more to the right. And so you shift and see how the curb feels under your feet at that point. And if this is a crossing that you're going to make regularly, then you'll want to kind of memorize that angle under your feet that you want to establish to get a good alignment. Another thing is that you can have somebody help you to find some physical cue at the crossing that can work to give you a good heading. Maybe there's an electrical or traffic control device on that corner that has a side that is perpendicular to the crossing direction. You'll always get a better direction if you can find something to square off with than align with. Squaring off with means it's behind you, or it's something under your feet that goes across both feet, rather than something that's beside you, like a grass line or what's called a returned curb. Sometimes they make curb ramps that don't have a flare. They just have a curb turning in beside them. That is normally going to be in aligned with the direction of the crosswalk, but it's really hard to get a good heading from that. That's just not something that our body alignment allows us to do very well. So you try to get something you can square off with always. You might not have anything. Use something you can get beside. Another thing that I want you to know about that is seldom seen still. It has existed now for about 4 years, but for whatever reason is not yet being used very much, but I want you to know about it so that you can advocate for it. And that is an audible APS beacon. And it's like a regular APS when you use it, in terms of the push button and the sound locator tone coming from the push button and the walk indication coming from the push button. But the thing that makes it a beacon is that there are loudspeakers that are mounted up on top of the visual pedestrian signal at each end of the crosswalk. And if this is programmed to give you an audible beacon, which any of the manufacturers of accessible pedestrian signals now can provide, when you actuate that, you're going to, you know, you'll come up to it, you'll push it, you're hearing the locator tone, you push it, it says wait, and may say wait to cross Howard at Grand or something like that. And then you'll hear walk sign is on to cross Howard at Grand. So you start crossing, and then, you know, you don't get that walk signal very long. It's only 4 to 7 seconds long. So you may not have time to get more than out into the first lane as you cross. And, but then, you know, where your APS changes goes back to the locator tone, or it may go to a countdown, and there are good reasons why it's not supposed to go to a countdown. It's supposed to go locator tone. At that time, you will hear a loud locator tone that comes from the loudspeaker on the other side of the other end of the crosswalk only, not from the end where you are. It only comes from out in front of you. So you can really home in on it and keep on homing in on it all the way across. Once per second, loud tone. It's only going to come when you actuate the button with a long button press. You know, you should get in the habit when you push the push button of always holding it for a second or more. Then you're going to get whatever that signal's got. And it could be more time even for crossing. It may just be increased volume, but if you're having trouble getting across the street straight, maybe it's a diagonal crossing. Maybe it's an incredibly wide street. An audible beacon can really, really help. It gives you a sound right in front of you to head for while you're out in the middle of the street. And so that the audible APS beacon is something that can really solve your problem if you're having trouble going straight across the street. And so it's something you should ask for, especially if there's already an audible signal there. Can you make an audible beacon? It's pretty simple. Doesn't cost very much money if you've already got an APS there. Another thing that is used somewhat is a tactile guide strip next or within the inside the crosswalk. It may be close to one line. It may be in the middle of the crosswalk, but it's inside the crosswalk anyhow. And you find that and just follow it with your cane. Well, how do you know if there's one there? Usually, you'd be able to hear cars cross it. And that can indicate not only that, oh, there seems to be something here I can follow, I think, and where it is. And so you can look for it with your cane. So I hope you're following me on all of this. I'm not giving you too much all at once here, because I want to talk about bike lanes next. You know, bike advocacy is so strong that pedestrians are kind of an afterthought in a lot of designs. And this is really regrettable. So many people who are in planning, or they may have a special position within your jurisdiction that's called the ped bike coordinator. Oftentimes these are really bike people, and they're going to emphasize making it safer and easier for bikes, and pedestrians seem like kind of an afterthought. But most commonly still, bikes are in the street, and they're usually in the lane closest to the curb. And where bikes are supposed to be is indicated only by paint. So, you know, bicyclists are saying, we don't feel safe that way. Nothing between us and cars. We want something between us and cars. We want protected bike lanes is the buzzword. Protected bike lanes. Okay. Protected for who? Not for people who are blind. That's for sure. And so we have protected bike lanes for cyclists, or they sometimes are called separated bike lanes. And these are a number of designs in which bikes are separated from cars by something or other more than just paint to protect cyclists. Now, bicyclists come in all kinds, like blind people do, and some of them are confident and skilled and feel perfectly safe traveling in the street with traffic, and others are kids who are learning to bike and moms with them trying to get them to the park safely, and not confident, not feeling comfortable traveling out in the street right together with traffic. And so there is a big movement for separating peds from bikes. So if it's done when the bikes are down at street level, then there's usually a relatively narrow median that separates them from the road. This means that if you're going to cross the street and you've got bikes traveling in the street near the curb, when you cross the street, you first cross that bike lane. Could be one or two way. More of them are one than two way, but it can be two way. Then that median should always be wide enough for you to wait on. When you make that crossing, that street crossing, and you're crossing the bike lane, you should always have a detectable warning where that crossing begins. There may or may not actually be a curb ramp, because they may have raised the crossing in the bike lane. This is so that it slows down bikes down, makes them more likely to yield. At least that's the theory. There's no research that says it actually does that. It also means it's easier for people with a mobility impairment. They don't have to go down and come up again to cross the street. But as far as you're concerned, there should be a detectable warning there indicating that this is where you cross. And if there isn't a curb ramp, it means you're just going to go across that crossing on the same level. But I mentioned before that in many cases now they're putting the bikes up on the same level as the sidewalk. And there is some recognition that there needs to be a detectable delineator, something that delineates this is the pedestrian side and this is the bike side. Now, in all cases that I have seen, the pedestrian side is always the side that's furthest from traffic, furthest from the street, closest to buildings, and the bikes are on the side that's closest to the street. So that's one way you can sort of keep yourself safe if you're on a sidewalk that also has bikes on the sidewalk. It's just staying closer to the building line, or what's sometimes called the inside shoreline. But there should be a detectable delineator between peds and bikes, detectable by cane and by foot. And it needs to be something that is unique, something that you, when you come to it, you know, don't cross me. There's bikes on the other side, not like the raised bars that say you can walk on either side if you're carrying something in one arm or you prefer to follow on one side, you can go on either side. Not so for a delineator that says there are bikes on the other side. You might not hear them. You'll be in danger if you cross this. So don't cross it. And it has to be highly detectable and recognizable so that, you know, it has a special meaning. Don't cross here. And yet it has to be crossable by pedestrians with mobility disabilities. It should never be used where crossing is intended. But sometimes a person who's using a wheelchair may need to be dropped off just right opposite the entrance to someplace they want to get to. And they get dropped off on a little median maybe that's between the bikes and the sidewalk, and then, or even dropped off right at the curb where their rate, bicycle track is raised. So they've got to cross that bicycle track and then cross whatever this delineator is. So it's got to be crossable by them. It doesn't have to be the easiest thing to cross. It just has to be something that can be crossed anyhow. So there's only one thing that so far has been found to really work for that, to satisfy all the requirements: detectable, recognizable, crossable by pedestrians with mobility disabilities. And that comes out of some research that I did in San Francisco with colleagues, and some of you may have participated in that in 2019. And the surface that met all of those requirements, detectable, recognizable, and crossable, was a shape that is a raised trapezoid, that just a strip of trapezoid that keeps on going, just like the raised bars would keep on going all along the way that there are bikes on the other side. To think what a trapezoid is shaped like, you might make a triangle, putting your thumbs together and then your index fingers together, and try to keep your thumbs in as straight a line as they make. My thumbs are kind of curly, so it's not a very straight line, but I'm imagining that's a straight line at the bottom of a triangle. And then I'm going to imagine putting a bar between the knuckles of my index fingers, right across that triangle. And I'm going to throw away the top part and just keep the bottom part. So I've got a longer flat surface at the bottom, it slopes up, and then it's narrower at the top. And when these are installed, the base is about 10 to 12 inches wide, and the top is 6 to 7 inches wide, and they're very gradually sloping up on the sides. So they're not a tripping hazard. And they're very recognizable when you contact them, especially with your foot. Less so with a cane, although so many people can recognize them with a cane once they get used to knowing what they're looking for. But I think if you encounter this, you will find that you really recognize it. It's different than anything else. It's higher than the truncated domes. It's higher than the raised bars. Those are 1/4 inch high. The raised trapezoid is 3/4 of an inch high. And that may seem like a lot higher. It is proportionally, but it's still not very high. It's not high enough to be a tripping hazard. Otherwise it wouldn't be easy to cross by people with mobility disabilities. So very gradually sloping. And the meaning, if you encounter it, is this is a boundary. Don't cross it. There are bikes on the other side. Again, sometimes raised bars are being used in a situation like this, and they give a wrong message because you don't want to cross that. So if you're aware of a bike lane being installed at sidewalk level, get engaged and find out what they're putting in between pedestrians and bikes. It should be a raised trapezoid. That is the only thing that has been demonstrated to be highly detectable, highly recognizable, and still crossable. So how do you cross bike lanes anyhow? That is often the biggest concern about bikes, is how do you cross the darn bike lane when you have to cross it to cross the street, or maybe to get out to a floating bus stop? Remember that the crosswalk might be raised to the sidewalk level, but it should have a detectable warning on both ends. So look for the detectable warnings. They should be there on both sides of the bike lane. If there's a signal, use it. And if there's a signal, request an APS if there isn't one. The signal should be for crossing the bike lane as well as the street, but it might not be. And that's, again, something that is worth asking your local engineer, how that crossing is timed. Is there enough time in the signal for you to cross all the way from the sidewalk side of that bike lane all the way across the street, which probably means cross a bike lane, cross the street, cross another bike lane, get to the other side? Does the signal give you time enough to cross all of that? Or is the signal only timed to cross from one median between the bikes and the bike lane to the other medium? There really should be another push button out on the median so that you can start from the median in any case, but that's not always being done. There's design guidelines for constructing bike facilities are evolving. Now there might even be a special signal for bikes to stop, but they're not very commonly used yet. Well, you now know about things that a lot of traffic engineers don't know about that can really help you. And so there's really a need for advocacy. You know things that can help you go straight across the street. A really wide street where you're afraid of veering and there's no parallel traffic. You can have an audible beacon, or you could have a tactile guide strip. If you can't find crosswalks, say at a roundabout, channelized turn lane, mid-block crossing, You know that you can use that raised bar tactile direction indicator across the sidewalk to help you find crossings. And they also provide a good cue for alignment, provided that the bars are perpendicular to your crossing direction. That's a very important part about installation here that is not self-evident. People will get used to thinking about the bars going, so the bars themselves are parallel with their direction of travel. It's the opposite way. If it's across the sidewalk to help you find a place to cross, or maybe a bus stop. If you're crossing from a corner and maybe there's a diagonal curb ramp, or maybe it's a skewed crossing and it's really hard to figure out how to align, just a simple square, 2 feet square of raised bars, again, perpendicular to your direction of travel across the street, so you can square off with it. That can help you get a direction very concretely. You can request, if it's a signalized intersection, you can request an APS with a beacon to give you something you can hear so that as you get out into the street, you can just home in on it all the way across. You could ask for a tactile guide strip. Now, you know, in California, probably you, I don't know that you have any place that regularly has snow, so probably a tactile guide strip would work pretty well. If you're in a northern place where you're dealing with snow and snow plows, then those will probably get torn up, so an audible beacon is probably a better idea. But either one can give you sure, confident guidance crossing the street. And remember that if you have a sidewalk, bikes at the sidewalk level, there's got to be something between them. And it should be a raised trapezoid that's like, it's not like the domes, it's not like the bars, it feels different, it's a little higher. And that is the thing that should be separating pedestrians and bikes at a bicycle path that is at sidewalk level. And these are new things. They're not well known. They're not widely used yet, but they are good tools that can really improve accessibility in some locations. So I encourage you to be an advocate, talk to a friend, family member, O&M specialist that might help you advocate. The first step is always finding the right person to talk to. Don't think that's going to be easy. It will probably take you several phone calls to get it figured out, but be able to describe as explicitly as you can where you're having trouble, and maybe invite the engineer out to see where you're having trouble and just what the trouble is. And be sure that they understand that your trouble crossing the street might impact vehicular traffic, not just you. If you can't cross the street efficiently, you may delay traffic. And many traffic engineers are still mostly concerned about vehicles. So if you can't do it, it may impact traffic too. So I hope I haven't talked too long to have some time for some questions here.
We do have a couple of three hands. First, we have Charlene.
Yes, Charlene.
Yes. I've been involved with Access in San Diego for some time. We use for a guide strip thermoplast, and they put it in three layers, which is kind of works nice because it naturally bevels and it's detectable. But the one question I really have for you is the newest thing coming up is what's called smart intersections, and they are computerized with an intelligent computer, supposedly, and using cameras to determine what pedestrian traffic is and how long mm-hmm. they're going to cross the street. So it will control light instead of just the traffic. But my concern is, how is a blind person going to get a pattern?
You can't, in fact, is the answer to that, because they change all the time. There should always be a pedestrian push button at an intersection at which the traffic pattern can change depending on how much vehicular traffic there is. There should always be a push button. And I would always advocate for an accessible pedestrian signal. Your best bet, if you don't have an accessible signal, is to cross with the closest lane of traffic when it's going straight ahead. It means you have to do awfully careful listening. It's cognitively pretty intense to make sure that the traffic in the lane closest to you is actually going straight. It's not turning. It means that you're delayed a few seconds getting off the corner as you listen to be sure that car is going straight. If it's not, it could be just a car that's accelerating to turn right on red. But when you hear in the list, be listening and focusing on that lane of traffic that's closest to you. It might be going the same direction that you are. It might be going the opposite direction. You know, if you're on a corner and your street is on your right, then your closest lane is going to be traffic that's coming toward you. So you're listening across the street for a car that's going straight. And that is the best way to tell when you have the pedestrian signal. Timing it's going to be very hard to tell by timing. It's quite possible if it's push button actuated that there won't be a pedestrian signal if nobody pushes the button. This won't exist. Sometimes a turning phase for vehicles. There may, for instance, a signalization may start out with traffic going in both directions being able to turn left. And it's really important that you not cross then because they're not anticipating pedestrians in the crosswalk. And they may be traveling quite fast. So you definitely don't want to cross then.
So all right. I'm sorry.
I'm not sure whether I answered your question sufficiently or not.
Okay, next we have 925.
Yeah, this is Earl. I live in a neighborhood that was developed around the 60s. It's 3/4 mile to the nearest shopping center. No electrical signals, none. Okay, there are ramps cut in every one at every intersection. Everyone pointed out right to the center of the intersection. That's of no use. Also, it was designed in the 60s and they were innovative. There's no corners. Everything just sweeps around in a 25-foot radius. So you can't tell where to cross.
Is there
in 3/4 of a mile, there's along... exactly... Go
is
ahead.
There a detectable warning all the way around that corner where it's level with the street?
No. Exactly once in 3/4 mile, there's one set of truncated domes.
Yikes.
Okay. So basically crossing the street, and by the way, yes, there are stop signs. But the idea of hearing an idling car,
mm-hmm.
When's the last time a car is actually stopped at a stop sign?
Mm-hmm.
It happens
mm-hmm.
occasionally,
mm-hmm.
but not often enough to worry about. So and the street's not perfectly straight. So hearing which way the traffic is going is sometimes not good either. Mm-hmm. So I've been blind for 7 years and I've yet to make it all by myself to the supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
These are the kind of odd things you know, there's no corners. You can't tell where the corner is.
Yeah.
It's not straight.
Yeah, it sounds like you need some advocacy in that neighborhood for getting detectable warnings in, which are required. They're not required retroactively, so you're asking for a retroactive accommodation. But when you can't access the shopping area that is in your neighborhood, you have a legitimate ADA complaint. And a way to solve that would be detectable warnings and then these direction indicators, the 2-foot square near the end of the detectable warning that is lined up so you can square off with it and get a certain direction, a sure direction.
Well, I like the idea of the detectable warning, you know, across the intersection where there's a little bump or something, a little ridge.
You mean going across the street?
Yeah,
a tactile guide strip.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's what it's called. I'll call up the traffic engineer. So I doubt that it'll ever happen, but, you know.
Yeah. And you might want to talk to Gene, and who was the person that said what they were doing in San Diego? You might want to talk to them about what's being used in where they live, just to get some ideas of ways it can be done. So good luck.
All right. Well, you know, and again, and bicycles, by the way, bicycles stop at nothing. I understand conservation of momentum. You know, they don't ever want to put on those brakes because they did a lot of work to get themselves up to speed.
Yeah.
And they run red lights, stop signs, you name it.
Yeah. If you were at Gene Bjorklund's session last year, you probably heard that the best thing you can do to influence bike stopping or cars for that matter is that there are three things really that help. And I would do all three. Is one, put up a hand in the direction of the oncoming traffic to say, you know, I'm going to cross here, stop. Now they may not see that. They may not pay attention. Flag with your cane. I mean, lift it up head height. Whump, whump, whump. I mean, this is a dramatic action. Just saying, I'm going to go here. Not, don't just, you know, don't do an arc in front of yourself. Raise it up and up and down several times. And then put 1 foot into the street and wait for about 2 to 3 seconds. And if you don't hear anything, probably there is nothing. Now, we know bikes are so hard to hear. There always can be. But that's giving them enough time and giving them enough dramatic influence. You're going to cross. You know, they're going to get spokes in the wheel. They're going to get whacked with a cane if they cross right now. So three things. The hand, the flagging with a cane, one step in the street, and the point of one step in, I mean, into the bike lane, but works for cars too. It is that you still got 1 foot on the curb or the curb ramp. You can back up. You know, if somebody's whizzing through, and you can back up. You know, just make it so obvious that you are crossing now and you have a right to cross now. And that's my best advice on that.
Okay.
All right. We have no more hands.
This is Gene.
Go ahead.
Yes, this is Gene Lozano again. And as BZ was sharing with you about the trapezoid, there are a few companies that are developing the design. There is one company, Strongo, who is actually has a product, and it's a form of concrete. And the question has arisen, and this would help, because I'm going to be having a meeting with the representative from Strongo and Sacramento County Department of Transportation people on May 25th. And that was, have this device, is there a need for an audible sound? Does there need to be adequate visual contrast?
Absolutely, there has to be visual contrast.
Yes, and they are very much in support of that. And we've talked about using red instead of yellow, so to denote, do not cross stop, do not cross over. And this has been passed by a few bicyclists in Sacramento, and they seem to be in favorable of the idea of the red that would conjure.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is whether there should be the audible sounds. Some of the blind community here, cane users, feel yes, they do want that additional auditory cue. And there are some people who say it doesn't make any difference.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, the product by Strongo probably is not going to give you much audible difference. There are products being available. There's one cast iron manufacturer that's working on making them in cast iron, and that should give you a difference in sound. There is one company that's working on making them in, I'll call it plastic. It's a lot more complicated than that, but that would give you a difference in sound probably too.
We do have two more hands raised. First is David.
Yes, David.
Is it my turn? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. My
screen
was chattering.
Yes.
Very briefly, BZ, I've met you because I'm on the Transportation Committee of ACB. Mm-hmm. And this is great timing and wonderful information because a number of us are meeting with our local MPO in the San Francisco Bay Area on the 19th, this coming Thursday, to begin our discussion of regional wayfinding and accessibility standards. And
wow,
it would be very helpful if you could please, if you are able to send me an outline, a brief outline of what you gave us today.
That I would be very happy to make that available.
We would be very grateful. I won't give you my email right here, but if you can send it to the TransEEC list, or I can contact you and send you my email privately.
Okay.
But we just want to let you know we're very excited about this.
Yeah, I'd be happy to make my...
Okay. Thank you very much.
...talk that I just gave available to you.
This is wonderful. Thank you.
Okay, and Charlene.
One thing that is helpful in making sound that people can't avoid when they're using cars or bicycles is to put saw cuts in the pavement. It does help make a rumble sound, and it's not expensive for them to do. And unless you have a lot of sand or something flowing that would fill up the saw cuts, and maybe it would depend on how deep they are, that has been a real asset, or inlaid brick. But those are two ways of making sound
mm-hmm.
that San Diego's used.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right, that seems to be the last of our hands for now.
I wish to thank you very much, BZ, for giving your morning to us. This, I imagine, will be the beginning of some future follow-up conversations and possibly other presentations. And BZ will be giving a similar presentation at the American Council of Blinds convention that I'm not recalling the exact date, but please look at the joint program of the Pedestrian Environmental Access Committee and the Transportation Committee, the ACB convention, so you can find that. And by then, there may be some new developments. And again, thank you very much, BZ, and look forward to talking to you and working with you soon.
My great pleasure to be talking to California Council of the Blind.
Okay, have a good morning. And it's yours, Rob.
Okay, well, thank you, Gene, for an excellent panel and some great tips that will be hopefully coming in handy and give us some ideas of how to advocate for some of these things. So just a reminder, this afternoon at 2:00, we've got our Diving into Literature. That's going to be a discussion with Alice and Susan Glass, Alice Turner and Susan Glass, about her new book and various things. And then after that, of course, we have the Kelly Brakenhoff, who we remember from last year, has those wonderful stories that she describes. So that's after that. And then, of course, at 6 o'clock p.m., we have our banquet. And so tune into that. So I think that's about it. Does anybody have anything they want to mention before we do our door prize drawing and wrap this session up? Okay, Ms. Lisa, are you around?
I am here.
All right, let's do another door prize and then we'll wrap this up.
Okay, we're doing $25 Amazon gift card given by the Contra Costa chapter. Let's do a good shuffle here and let's go. And the winner is Debbie Cordero. Congratulations,
Debbie. Hey, Debbie. Okay. Debbie and Donna will be happy, I'm sure. So, hey. All right, everybody. We'll hope everybody's enjoyed this morning session. I know I have. And we'll look forward to being back here again at 2 o'clock. So for now, take care, everybody.